Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today, the show where we talk all about sleep and the science behind what's going on. We have an interesting show today because we're going to be talking about why I can't stay awake, which is the opposite of what we often talk about when we talk about insomnia. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and our guest today is Dr. Harir Attarian, MD. He is a professor of neurology, and he works with narcolepsy. So, doctor, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
We're glad to have you. It's always important to us to have the real experts who can explain the science to us behind what's actually going on. So today we're going to talk about narcolepsy, and I wonder if you could start us off by giving us just the basics. What is narcolepsy, and how is it, you know, impacting people?
Narcolepsy is a neurological condition in which a specific neurotransmitter in the brain that's involved in keeping us awake is missing, or the cells producing it are damaged. And hence it presents with daytime sleepiness, dreamlike episodes while awake, disturbed sleep. Symptom that's common in narcolepsy is this scary feeling of being paralyzed while falling asleep or waking up, called sleep paralysis. Sometimes it's associated with auditory or visual hallucinations during that time, like feeling like someone's in the room, or feeling something on one's chest. And in about half of narcolepsy patients, it's also associated with a unique feature called cataplexy, and that is sudden weakness or paralysis of facial, neck, limb muscles due to strong emotion, usually laughter or anger, but it could also be excitement or other strong emotions.
Wow, so there's a lot going on there. Are these different types of narcolepsy, or does everybody with narcolepsy experience all these things?
So everybody with narcolepsy experiences daytime sleepiness.
Okay.
Basically, you can't have narcolepsy if there's no daytime sleepiness. That is an essential symptom. In half the people, they're known as narcolepsy type 1. They also have the cataplexy. The other three symptoms of disturbed sleep, sleep paralysis, hallucinations, those can vary between both narcolepsy with cataplexy and narcolepsy without cataplexy. Some people may not experience them at all. For others, it may be a big problem.
So, all right. So I'm just trying to get my head around this. So typically, you know, when I, growing up, I hear the word narcolepsy, and the definition that I, you know, get is that people fall asleep during the day. I've even, you know, had occasion prior to doing sleep work, I practiced law, and I actually worked with an opposing attorney who had narcolepsy, and we would be in deposition and he would just fall asleep. It was, so I've experienced it from that perspective. But explain this to me then. So I can understand that you and I might be sitting here, and if I had narcolepsy, it's possible I could kind of doze off. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about cataplexy with my muscles freezing and things, mm-hmm. do people just like fall into sleep when they're standing up and fall over?
No. They don't. No, that's a myth usually perpetuated by a media representation of narcolepsy. Unfortunately, for often inappropriately comedic reasons, mm-hmm. Cataplexy. The person during cataplexy episode is fully awake.
Okay.
It's just that they have. No tone, either in their face or their face sags, usually with this is common in children, mm-hmm. Or their neck drops, or there's a moment where their knees buckle and they feel like they're going to fall. Rarely they completely collapse, but they're still fully awake.
Okay. And so how long would an episode of cataplexy normally last?
If you leave the person alone and don't make a fuss around them, it usually lasts shorter, usually less than a minute, or max a minute, minute and a half. But mm-hmm. if people start making a fuss that increases the anxiety and excitement in the person, that may prolong the episode. In rare cases, partial cataplexy of the face, or particularly, may last on and off for hours.
Wow. So what would be the best thing for a person to do if they had a loved one who had cataplexy? What would be the best thing for them to do?
Best thing for them to do is just to reassure the person and let them recover. And if they're in public, advise others around them that this is okay and not to make too much of an excitement around it.
Okay, great. So I also wonder then, because you were talking about, misdiagnosis and misunderstandings about narcolepsy, does the medical community, or doesn't have to be the medical community, is something like cataplexy often misdiagnosed or misrecognized as something else, like a stroke or some other issue?
Yes. In fact, I can tell you a couple of stories. A long time ago, when I was a sleep fellow, we had one of our patients who was having cataplexy and was on the usual treatment for cataplexy, which was low-dose antidepressant medication, mm-hmm. because they suppress REM, and cataplexy is inappropriate partial REM sleep intruding into wakefulness.
Hmm.
So this person was on a low dose of antidepressants, gets admitted for the hospital for something else. They stop the medication. Because they stopped the sedating medication to be able to monitor patient's alertness.
Okay.
She starts having cataplexy. So they don't know what it is. They think it's seizures.
Mm.
So they put the EEG electrodes on their head, and they see no abnormalities. So they say she must be having a psychogenic event. These are not real. And then when they reintroduce the antidepressant, the cataplexy, resolves. So that for them, that's proof. Aha, see, this must have been psychiatric because we put the antidepressant on it, it went away.
Right.
And then another case was a patient who, as a young child, due to very tragic and unfortunate mismanagement of seizures at a small hospital, ended up with devastating neurologic damage, mm. and was having was followed in the epilepsy clinic, and she was doing okay, with however okay she can be, And then she suddenly started having these drop attacks, and she would drop. And the neurologists, again, did EEG. They couldn't figure out what's going on. And then as she was being monitored, they noticed that the dad, who's there with her, constantly falls asleep. So they asked the dad if he had narcolepsy, and he said yes. And then we, you know, figured out that the teenager was also having cataplexy, and these were not part of a regular seizure.
Wow, wow. That's, you know, it's scary because of the fact that, you know, look, I realize doctors get a lot of training and there's a lot of stuff for them to learn and be aware of, but no human being can be aware of every single thing. And it's scary when some of these things come up and they just don't know. What about the ones where you said sometimes people can have hallucinations? Mm-hmm. Is that something that happens, like how intense is that? And do you have any stories of what actually happens?
Yeah, so they can be very complex and intense, and they're often misdiagnosed as psychiatric problems.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most complex cases I remember, this older narcolepsy patient telling me that he would see these women with traditional Somali garb come out of his closet and cook food and etc. And they were very vivid, and he realized at some level that this is not real.
Mm-hmm.
But they would happen at the same time as he was paralyzed and unable to move.
Wow.
But usually it's more of somebody calling their name, or the sound of a glass breaking, or feeling a presence behind them. They're usually not as complex as that one particular patient.
Mm-hmm.
One of the common stories I've heard is the feeling that they're above themselves, looking down on themselves.
Hmm. Wow. So then let me make sure that I'm getting this right in general about narcolepsy. So we're talking about several things here where the person is aware, but maybe in cataplexy, their muscles are frozen and whatever. But are there parts of narcolepsy where the person literally falls asleep and they're not aware, and then other parts where they are aware? Or does narcolepsy mean you're always aware?
So to put it all in perspective, I want to just give a 2-minute overview of the underlying physiology of narcolepsy.
Yeah, please.
Because alertness is such an important evolutionary feature, we have a redundant circuitry for wakefulness and alertness in our brain. There are multiple neurotransmitters that all do contribute to wakefulness. In addition to that, they do something different. Foraging behavior or fight or flight, or in, they have a secondary advantage. So the neurotransmitter that's missing in people with narcolepsy, called orexin, in addition to keeping people alert, it maintains the boundaries between the three states of being, which are wakefulness, non-rapid eye movement sleep, and rapid eye movement sleep. When it's gone, these boundaries are all blurred. So people feel sleepy during the day, REM intrudes into wakefulness intrudes into sleep. So a lot of the time, parts of their brains are awake and other parts are actually in REM sleep.
Hmm. Wow. That's... It's hard to get, you know, your mind around that because it's so unique. But let's do this. This is a perfect spot for us to take a commercial break. So let's do that, and we'll come back, and then let's talk about the actual diagnosing of narcolepsy. So we'll be back right after this commercial.
UK the station that makes you feel good.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Dr. Atarian about narcolepsy. And when we came back, we said we were going to talk about diagnosis. So what is the best way or the right way for someone to actually diagnose these conditions?
So majority of the time, the best way to diagnose narcolepsy is to have them either self-monitor or monitor with actigraphy, which is a medical-grade, basically, smartwatch. Mm-hmm. Their sleep-wake patterns for a week, make sure they're getting enough sleep, then at the end of that week, have them come and spend the night in the sleep lab. And then in the morning when they wake up, 2 hours after awakening, ask to take a 20-minute nap. And then the cycle repeats for 5 times, for a total of 5 naps.
Okay.
And then if you document that the week prior, they slept sufficiently, the night of the study, their sleep was relatively normal, there was nothing disturbing it, and then on the nap portion of the test, they fell asleep on the average in under 8 minutes. And excuse me.
Sure, bless you.
Thank you. And then they went into rapid eye movement sleep during a short 20-minute nap at least twice out of 5 times, 5 opportunities. Mm-hmm. Then that's how narcolepsy has been diagnosed for decades. That's still the best or most common way to diagnose it. Now, over the past few years, probably 5 years or so, there is an assay that can be done on the spinal fluid of people with narcolepsy that looks for the neurotransmitter orexin. And if the orexin is significantly low, then you have a diagnosis of narcolepsy. Unfortunately, however, if the orexin is normal, that does not necessarily rule out narcolepsy. Because in slightly less than 5% of people with cataplexy, the orexin levels may be normal in the spinal fluid, and then in about half of those without cataplexy, it may be normal in the spinal fluid. Not to mention that the patient has to come to the outpatient clinic, undergo a procedure where they put a needle and take fluid and then rest. So it's more invasive, even though it saves time. There's no lengthy testing. And as I said, negative results don't rule out narcolepsy.
Wow. So it sounds like a lot of work and expense and pain and whatever, and still not getting a clear result. So then I want to make it clear, the typical commercial or consumer devices like an Apple Watch and things like that that have these sleep settings, none of those are going to be effective in helping someone figure out narcolepsy.
No, because those may they're becoming more and more reliable as far as total sleep duration, but they are not very accurate in determining whether you're in REM sleep or non-REM sleep, or if you have awakenings in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess step one for someone would be if they notice themselves or they have their spouse or loved ones notice that they might have this cataplectic type of event, or they might be just kind of like nodding off or exhibiting signs that would cause them to wonder what's going on. And then is there a genetic component? Like, do they need to see if there's someone in their family that had narcolepsy?
Yes, there's definitely a genetic component. So narcolepsy is thought to be a sort of a two-hit phenomenon. There is the genetic predisposition, and there are specific HLA genes that have been mapped. Unfortunately, those are most accurate in people of Caucasian ancestry. Mm-hmm. And they're not as accurate representation in people of East Asian descent or of African descent. Mm-hmm. But yes, there is a genetic predisposition. You can have the gene and not have narcolepsy. And the second hit is thought to be a type of an immunologic reaction. Often we hear people say, you know, this symptom started in me after I developed mononucleosis, which is a Epstein-Barr virus infection. And there was this huge case series that came out of Germany and North Europe where after a specific type of flu vaccine, teenagers developed narcolepsy. So there's something that's predisposing the person, and mm-hmm. then there's the immunological insult that's reacting in this autoimmune process and leading to damage in the of those specific nerve cells.
I see. So if I'm someone who knows that I have narcolepsy in my family mm-hmm. tree, right? So I... is there anything that I can do to sort of prevent narcolepsy from coming on? Anything related to diet or different types of activities or anything?
Unfortunately, not. And as far as that flu vaccine from a decade or so ago, they're no longer using that type. There is nothing specifically you can do to prevent it. Now, having said that, narcolepsy remains a rare disorder. I mean, mm-hmm. we see a lot because we're a specialized referral center for sleep disorders. But in the general population, it's still quite rare. So even with a heightened risk, your risk is still rare. Still low.
Right. So if a person is diagnosed with narcolepsy and that they actually have narcolepsy, is there something or anything that they could or should be doing to lessen the impact, or is it just going to do what it's going to do?
So the sooner you diagnose, less of a quality of life impact you have on the people, right? Mm-hmm. We've had people lose their career and lose their jobs because they didn't know what they were having. And so the sooner you diagnose and treat, the less of a quality of life impact it has.
Mm-hmm.
Treatment, though, is symptomatic. So if you catch early and treat early, it's not going to make a difference in the overall pathology of the illness. But it will definitely help with the quality of life. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the most important thing is prevent accident.
Right.
Due to
right.
falling asleep.
So is this something that is a danger for someone if they had narcolepsy, any of the types we've been talking about, driving cars? Should they be driving?
I mean, they can drive with proper treatment.
Okay.
Certainly, I wouldn't recommend that they become cross-country truck drivers or without careful consideration and discussion with their physicians.
Mm-hmm.
Or airline pilots, again, without careful discussion and consideration.
Right.
But regular, you know, day-to-day driving, as long as they're treated, they're fine.
Okay, so let's talk about treatment then. What is the treatment? How effective is it? What do people need to know?
So the treatment is symptomatic. It's targeted at stopping the daytime sleepiness primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And also secondarily stopping the cataplexy and sleep paralysis and the hallucinations if they happen. There are a variety of medications on the market. All of them are quite effective. And majority of the time, people do extremely well, live normal lives, have a career anybody else can have, anybody without narcolepsy can have. The impact is basically educating their loved ones so that they understand, because all of these medications are highly controlled as far as because in non-narcolepsy people they have a abuse potential.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to regular, you know, if a cop pulls them over for something and finds amphetamines, you know, yes, this is for their, this is for a medicinal purpose and et cetera.
Right.
So other than that, the treatments are quite effective. Now, unfortunate thing is that all these treatments have side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And the real unfortunate thing is that with an aging population,
mm-hmm.
Older narcolepsy patients, like all older people, develop heart disease, high blood pressure, etc. And so we have to be extremely careful using these medications because they can exacerbate those conditions.
Right.
That's where I think we have a huge gap. We haven't come up, with the exception of a couple of very expensive medications, we haven't come up with something that's absolutely safe for people with high blood pressure, heart disease, so that we can target the primarily aging population and the narcolepsy patients in that
mm-hmm.
population.
Mm-hmm. Wow. But in general, someone who's being treated for narcolepsy, the primary treatment is a medication. I'm guessing it's a pill. They, what, take once a day?
It's a pill, once or twice a day. They all do the same. They all do variations on the same theme. They basically enhance wake-promoting neurotransmitters in the brain. We still don't have a medication that targets the missing neurotransmitter, the orexin.
Okay.
And there is one medication that's a liquid that's drank at bedtime. And it helps with waking up in the morning, feeling more alert, and it does help with cataplexy. There are three different versions of this medication.
Mm-hmm.
There's two short-acting ones that have to be dosed twice a night, and there's one long-acting one that can be taken at bedtime. Between the two short-acting ones, one has a high sodium, the other has low sodium.
Oh, Okay. Well, I have a follow-up question to that, but before I ask it, we're at a point for another commercial break here, so let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll continue our discussion.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We're talking about narcolepsy, and we were talking about treatment. And the question that I had is, if someone has narcolepsy, whether or not they're being treated, is it possible for them to then also have insomnia? Because if they're sleeping during the day, their sleep drive is not going to be so strong at night. What happens there?
Definitely, narcolepsy patients... over two-thirds of them have disturbed sleep at night.
Okay.
And any sleep specialist who sees narcolepsy patients can tell you that we've all encountered people who came to our clinic complaining of insomnia, and then actually the real diagnosis was narcolepsy. That's because, as you said, people with narcolepsy, unlike a related disorder called idiopathic hypersomnia, don't have an excessive need of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that their sleep is fragmented. It's all over the place over a 24-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sleepy during the day. So they have brief micro-sleep episodes that reduces their sleep drive, and they have disturbed sleep at night.
Wow. So if they're being treated properly for... for one, then it solves the other. In other words, the insomnia right. would go away if they're not sleeping
Correct.
During the day.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. So, and you hit upon something that was going to be another question of mine, which was the idiopathic hypersomnia. Mm-hmm. Can you describe for us what is that and how is it similar and different from other sleep disorders?
So idiopathic hypersomnia is a sort of a related condition to narcolepsy. As far as we can ascertain, given that both conditions are hugely underdiagnosed, the prevalences are about the same, somewhere in the order of 0.03 to 4%.
Mm-hmm.
It's a condition where there is a increased need for sleep.
Okay.
And there's two types of that as well. There's the one with long sleep, where they definitely require 12, 14, 15 hours of sleep to be functional.
Wow.
And if they get that, they're fine, which is, obviously not possible to tell somebody sleep 16 hours and only function 8 hours a day. And then there's the other type where they sleep normal at night. They may not have excessive sleep need, maybe 9-10 hours, but then they continue to be sleepy during the day. Some of the key features is that idiopathic hypersomnia patients rarely have hallucinations, if ever.
Mm-hmm.
They rarely have, they never have cataplexy. They often don't have disturbed sleep. Their sleep architecture is normal. And their naps are usually very long, and they don't necessarily feel refreshed.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. So plan. If you had idiopathic hypersomnia, planning to take naps and all sounds like it wouldn't even make much of a difference. Is that right?
Correct. In fact, some people say that taking naps makes them wake up worse because they can't wake up after 30, 40 minutes. They have to sleep a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. And in a minority of them, it interferes with their ability to fall asleep at night, even though they've been sleepy and drowsy and draggy all day.
Right, right.
While in narcolepsy, asking them to take short naps during the day is a valid therapeutic intervention.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about, you know, medication available for narcolepsy. Is there something similar that's available for idiopathic hypersomnia?
Until 2021, there wasn't anything specifically related to idiopathic hypersomnia. Until I think it was 2015 or 2016, whenever the ICD-9, the International Classification of Diseases, the ninth version came out, there mm-hmm. wasn't even a recognized code for idiopathic hypersomnia.
Wow.
So currently there's only one medication, which is a medication that's the nighttime liquid medication that's also used for narcolepsy. But we've been treating for decades now idiopathic hypersomnia with the same medications that we treat narcolepsy to keep them more alert.
Mm-hmm.
Success rate from a perspective of making them able to go to work, come home, take care of family is probably similar to narcolepsy, but the success rate of them feeling energized and awake and alert and able to go beyond their daily necessities, we're less successful in that with idiopathic hypersomnia because we really don't fully understand the underlying pathophysiology. There's credible evidence to suggest that maybe there's an excess of a sleep neurotransmitter in the brain that doesn't dissipate sufficiently, but that's a credible theory based on some indirect experimental results. It's not as 100% proven like it is with narcolepsy.
I see. Okay. So we talked about sort of narcolepsy and also insomnia and how mm-hmm. those two kind of may interact. Are there other common sleep disorders, or are there other common medical disorders that someone with narcolepsy should be aware of?
Mm-hmm. One thing people should be aware of is that you can definitely have common sleep disorder like sleep apnea if you have narcolepsy.
Oh.
Right? Because sleep apnea is very common. Just because you have one doesn't mean you can't have the other.
Right.
So orexin is indirectly involved in appetite as well, on average, I'm not speaking about individuals, but if you look at the population of narcolepsy patients, they tend to have slightly higher body mass indices.
Hmm. Okay. All right.
So that increases slightly their risk of having sleep apnea.
Right.
So just because somebody has narcolepsy, we shouldn't dismiss the fact that they may also have sleep apnea and vice versa.
Right.
There is some, indirect evidence that patients with narcolepsy may be at higher risk for some other autoimmune disorders like autoimmune thyroiditis autoimmune gastrointestinal problems, even slightly higher risk for diabetes type 1.
Wow.
But again, these are indirect correlative studies, and we all know that large retrospective correlative studies have huge limitations.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be learned yet about sleep, and you know, I was talking to another guest just recently about how new sleep medicine is. You know, we're talking the 1970s to 1990s is what we were talking about on this other show. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this then: when it comes to narcolepsy, are there certain groups that are more prevalent to have it than others in terms of male, female, certain ages, certain you know, populations?
There's no difference between male and female. That's okay. Being looked at and, you know, proven that the prevalence is equal. Second, as far as different populations, it's hard for me to say that it's more common in some populations versus others, because studies have been not consistent in different areas of the world.
Okay.
Some places like Japan, they have a very seamless and easy to query medical record database that's nationwide, versus you take some developing nations where people are still using paper charts. So I hesitate to say that it's more common in one part of the world versus the other, just mm-hmm. based on the available data, because
right.
you know, we may not be asking the right questions, you know, the right type of tools aren't used to diagnose or query the diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
As far as age group, there is a peak usually in late teens, early to mid-20s for the onset of diagnosis.
Okay.
There's a smaller peak in mid-30s. But narcolepsy has been diagnosed in people as young as 3 or 4 years old, as a new onset, obviously new onset, and then as a new onset diagnosis, the oldest reported case was 70 years old.
Wow, wow.
I mean, in this particular person, it may have been due to a minor stroke,
mm-hmm.
but it was a new onset diagnosis at age 70.
Right. So does body mass or menopause or anything like that have any impact?
No.
Okay. All right. So we're basically out of time for the show. This has been really enlightening. I've learned a lot myself. Let me just ask, are there any resources that you're aware of that would be good for people if they had more questions and wanted to learn more about narcolepsy? Any mm-hmm. good places for them to go? What would that be?
Narcolepsy Network is a great resource.
Okay.
I always recommend to my patients the book by Julie Flyger called Wide Awake and Dreaming. She's a narcolepsy activist and awareness activist, and this is her own memoirs of living with narcolepsy. It's a phenomenal book. And also going to her website, I'm sorry, I don't remember the website, but if you search Julie Flyger, Flygare, she has a lot of useful information. She's been instrumental over the past 20 years in increasing awareness of narcolepsy.
Great. I'll try and put that information in the notes of the episode so you can see that online if you go visit our YouTube channel. But, Doctor, I want to thank you again for your time. We're out of time
for
this episode.
Thank you
for inviting me. Yep. So those of you listening, please visit us at sleepsciencetoday.com. Excuse me. I'll put up the information about the book that the doctor was talking about, and you can listen to this episode or see us on YouTube. Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you on another episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thank you for- for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.